welcome to Time to Talk Science and Medicine. I'm Dr. Charlie Highmarch, an assistant professor and researcher at Queen's University.
And I'm Stephen Archer, a cardiologist researcher and director of the Translational Institute of Medicine, which we affectionately refer to as TIME.
In this series, we sit down with some of the most accomplished translational scientists and clinicians from Queen's and around the world in order to explore ideas that are shaping the future of medicine. Every guest brings with them a dangerous idea, and this is an idea that, if proven true, would change the way that we understand disease, shift the direction of research, or transform patient care. We also want to meet the person behind the science, what drives them, what inspires them, and what keeps them curious. Today is a special edition of our show because today we are hosting our annual TIME Symposium for our membership.
And we're very fortunate today to have Dr. Trevor Pugh, who presented a fantastic medical grand rounds this morning, join us as our guest. He'll also be delivering a lecture during our plenary session in the fourth annual TIME Symposium this afternoon. Trevor is an internationally recognized cancer genomics researcher and expert in clinical molecular biology. He holds appointments from Princess Margaret Cancer Centre in Toronto, the Ontario Institute for Cancer Research, and the University of Toronto. His lecture today was absolutely fascinating, and I'm sure we'll hear more about that today, the idea of measuring fragments of DNA circulating in our blood as a cancer diagnostic test, which seems like sci-fi, but I'm sure he'll tell us it's reality. So, Trevor, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today. And before we get into your scientific work, we want to delve into your past and get your origin story. So how did you wind up as a molecular biologist? How did you get to this position you're in now? Where did you start?
I can say it wasn't planned right from the beginning, and I can confidently say my job today did not exist when I was growing up, and I think that's true for most people, is science moves so quickly now that where we thought we were going to be when we were 2 or 5 is very different from where we ended up now. I'm originally from Vancouver, from a fairly medical family. My dad was an ER doc. My mom was a nursing instructor at UBC, so we always kind of had medicine on the mind and at the dinner table. My dad would always come home with these gross out tales of broken bones or horrible responses. But it was always my mom who sort of countered with, well, like the why. She kind of planted that early genetic seed as to why do some people break their bones? Why do some people have bad reactions to certain things? And I think that was sort of that first genetics germ that kind of set me on my way, to where I am now.
And so did you study a lot of science when you were an undergrad? Were you pointed at genetics after that little seed from your mother, or did you wander into that?
I think I was unconsciously pointed in that direction. I was definitely the tech guy growing up. I was the kid who took apart the toaster and put it back together. My high school and early undergrad job, me and two buddies, Cam Vertesi and Jed Horvath, we started Quick Tech Computer Consulting. So this was an in-home computer repair business. So three keen kids, we'd go out to people's homes, fix their computer, but it would almost turn into a tutoring session as well. So Cam became in-home computer repair and ad hoc computer lessons. And that sort of got us thinking about how computers and people can kind of intersect.
And of course, setting yourself nicely up for an academic career where you're using technology, but also teaching at the same time.
We do use a lot of computers.
Yeah, that's right. And hopefully you know the prime rule of IT, which is turn it off and turn it on.
That's 100%.
That's as far as I've gotten.
On an hourly rate, we try to
make it longer than that.
That's where the tutorials usually came in, yes.
So you go to university and do you immediately start studying genetics or?
No, my undergrad is in biochemistry and chemistry, and I did a minor in commerce because I was interested in startups and this company we started, Quick Tech Computer Consulting. But I was more in the, I guess, like the hard scientists. Our chemistry courses were all about orbitals and how organic chemistry, how to synthesize drugs. But it was really the UBC co-op program that fully derailed me off of all that. My first co-op position was with Andre Marziali in the physics and astronomy program at UBC, and he was working on DNA sequencing technology in a pipette tip. So the idea was you'd aspirate reagents in this little piece of plastic, and then my job was to code a robot that would wash water at different temperatures to do a thermal cycling reaction. And that was my first taste of genetics, that you could actually sequence DNA in a pipette tip just by having near boiling hot water, bring it back to room temperature, and then heat it up again.
So you got into genetics by working with microfluidics and engineering. That's a novel route into the field.
Yes, but we didn't use those words at the time.
No, of course.
I think that sums it up perfectly.
Sounds much sexier.
You're allowed to reverse engineer your experience, I
understand. More polished than I am, Charlie.
So then you finally get interested in genetics, and but now you're a clinical geneticist that works on humans, even though you're not like a practicing physician, but your whole study is like of human genetics. So how did you get from like a pipette to people?
The real hook was that move from Andre's lab into the Michael Smith Genome Sciences Center at the BC Cancer Agency. Mm-hmm. So that's a full-fledged cancer hospital. That group was led by Mark O'Mara, but I actually joined Dwayne Smilas, who was the technology development guy, and he always had some amazing microfluidic or other technology on the go to make DNA sequencing, then very short sequences, make DNA sequencing higher throughput, cheaper, and applicable to human samples. And it was that last hook that sort of got me thinking, and my supervisor with Marco, about how could we take these fundamental sequencing technologies and link them to clinical action?
Yeah, it is sort of interesting. There's a lot of roots into medical science, like, and bringing sort of your basic science slash computer knowledge was obviously something that Marco recognized as a useful tool for his enterprise, which is a substantial enterprise, that's for sure.
Well, and that was the team up, I think, of Steve Jones' computational technique, Marco's like unbelievable intuition for where the puck's going to go scientifically, and putting these together, because you can't have one without the other. You have to have the lab, you have to have the compute, especially at massive scale. But that third pillar is that clinical integration as well. And that's actually where, as I went through my PhD, where Janessa Laskin came in. So a medical oncologist looking at lung cancer. And at that time, they're trying to figure out what's the biomarker for responding to these new class of targeted agents. And that further derailed me even deeper into the cancer genetics world.
So that's it's a wonderful point for me to break the origin story question and actually move on to something we like to call the dangerous idea, which is an idea that, if true, that you're working on would change the face of the way that we do things or the way that we do our science. So what's your dangerous idea?
Yeah, my dangerous idea is it's all in the blood. I think all of human health and biology is all circulating somewhere in our own liquid and liquids and fluids. Initially, germline genetics being the more obvious one, but there's a lot of biology in those free-floating pieces of DNA, certainly in cancer patients, but in all of us. And the key is going to be trying to figure them out.
Yeah, so you were talking in Medical Ground Rounds this morning as part of our sort of special time edition about the fragmentome and how that correlates. So maybe you can tell us a little bit about the fragmentome as being a constituent of blood, because that was novel for me.
I used to shy away from this term of fragmentome because everything's an ome these days. But this is a very credible use of the term because it's a new way to look at the human genome. When we were looking at tissues in my PhD and postdoc, we were taking DNA out of cells and artificially fragmenting them so they'd be compatible with our sequencer. It turns out our human body does that fragmentation naturally. The only difference is, unlike what we would do in the lab, it's non-random. So where that DNA breaks is totally reflective of the cell of origin of that piece of DNA. And that's the knowledge we're trying to bring to diagnose cancer, because you're going to get different DNA breaks in cancer patients or coming from cancer cells than you would from all your healthy cells.
And are these kind of breaks, are they unique to an individual? Or if you find a break in some people, can you translate that breaking point to others so that you get a test that's good for everyone?
I think this is the research question we're trying to answer now, is what are the common breaks? We know everybody's different, but there are going to be some commonalities and common biological mechanisms that define how cell-free DNA gets fragmented. And that's the big data opportunity, is to start pooling all this data into one place and start to look for those patterns in different disease contexts, not just cancer.
So if I understand it now, do you have to track this back to the mutations that are in the cancer cells and know that, and then measure those same mutations in circulating blood? Or are you just making basically a barcode of fragments of any old type of DNA that's out in the blood, and the pattern is different in a cancer patient, a person with cancer, than it is in a person without cancer?
In its current form today, we're using these tumor-informed based approaches. So right now, we need that answer key. We learn a lot from tumor tissues, and we take that learning and apply it to cell-free DNA. the future state I see is we're going to be able to build these models, just like we've built for language, we've built for imaging. I think there's going to be a model for cell-free DNA, the language of how it breaks or where the sequence changes happen, and we'll be able to apply that agnostically to anyone without needing access to the tumor tissue.
And it's sort of interesting as a non-expert in this area, but your talk highlighted this. I mean, there's a lot of things you could measure. You can measure mutations in the DNA, like sequences that are not the normal sequence for that gene in the fragment. You can measure whether it's methylated or not methylated. You do something with the chromatin structure. So there's about three or four parameters or measurements that you're making that allow you to assess these fragments. And you're measuring like thousands of fragments, right?
I mean, the exciting part about this type of work is it's not thousands or tens of thousands, it's billions and trillions. Mm. And this is where...
It's very Carl Sagan.
Well, this is where genomics and information technology have had this virtuous cycle for decades now, because you can generate the data, then you need to find the patterns. Those patterns inform the next generation of technology. So that single piece of DNA is just packed with information. And it's not just the cancer cells, actually the immune cells, to me, are actually the even more interesting population, because that sequence could have a T cell receptor. It could have a breakpoint that tells you about a B cell response or some other cell that's actively proliferating.
Well, I was thinking as you talk, because you do these tests and then they're correlated with the standard clinical diagnostics. We do this test. We think you might have cancer. We get a PET scan, a positron emission tomogram that lights up. And of course, the PET scan is lighting up because of enhanced glycolysis in cancer patients. So for example, do you envision that this test would look for fragments that are related to glycolysis, to sugar metabolism, that might predict the positive PET scan? Or is it just more focused on that sequence or that pattern is abnormal and you may have a positive PET scan, not because of those fragments, but because of something else, but that detects it?
Well, I think this is the true killer app. Genomics never exists in a vacuum. It really is greater than the sum of the parts when you start to add on these other data types. So genomics, I think, will send you in the right direction, but these other confirmatory or complementary technologies let you answer these other questions.
So this is like GWAS 2.0, where the associations between cell-free signatures and other classifiers becomes, you know, useful.
I think, but that's also the scale that you're going to need, is GWAS kind of population scale. And a big part of this is going to be the infrastructure to lift some of these very heavy data sets that are genomics, that are imaging, potentially lifestyle, potentially medical records. It can get quite complicated quite quickly.
Yeah, it's interesting. You have to tell the home audience what GWAS is.
Genome-wide association studies is the idea that you can correlate signatures in the DNA back to outcomes in the clinic or kind of that you can measure in humans.
And you can tell this is a dangerous idea because my friend and colleague Elizabeth Eisenhower was at the rounds this morning and immediately had lots of questions about how DNA signatures relate to clinical outcomes and, you know, early diagnosis. Do we just have more time where you worry about having cancer, or do we have more time to intervene to actually prevent the cancer or treat the cancer? So as soon as you open up this whole new area of research, suddenly there's 1,000 questions that emerge from that.
Well, that's the best part of coming here to visit all of you, coming back with a head full of new questions and new ideas and new collaborations. So yeah, even just in one line of questioning, all these new interesting directions really come to light. It's really fun.
We'll ask you a crystal ball question later on, but I mean, it is sort of interesting because you could see the audience was thinking about whether monitoring therapy, whether you'd see a signature when you use one type of therapy or not on your circulating DNA pattern, in addition to its ability to early diagnose cancer. And I'm not sure where you have any thoughts on that.
Well, this is why we've jumped straight to whole genome sequencing, because it's the technology that ages extremely well. We keep going back to that data with new ideas over and over, and it's applicable throughout the disease course. In the case of cancer, cancer predisposition, a lot of our work in the CHARM Consortium with Raymond Kim has really been around what do fragmentation patterns look like before you have cancer. But then some of that other work with Anand Ganekar has been looking at liver cancer post-surgery, totally different scenario, actually the same test. And that's actually how my lab is set up. We have a pretty short list of technologies. It's all whole genome sequencing, T-cell receptor sequencing, and single cell. But then each trainee goes very deep in their disease type or their medical domain. But then they can all talk to each other and share notes around how does a study in multiple myeloma improve our knowledge of brain cancer or of hereditary tumors.
And it's interesting. So again, for people listening that are not experts, are geneticists themselves. So when you say whole genome sequencing, can you explain what that is and what's the difference between whole genome, whole exome, and single cell sequencing? What are those technologies and why does it matter?
Yeah, so whole is entire. So we're not doing any selection. If the DNA is in the blood, we want to sequence it. Genome is all your DNA. So it's the gene collection. We're not doing targeted focused work on any one gene. We're interested in the dark matter, used to be called junk DNA. It's absolutely not. We want to gather up all that data. And sequencing is marching through all 3-6 billion bases per cell and looking for differences. How do your cancerous cells compare to healthy cells? But then at the population level, how do those cancers share or have different characteristics?
Yeah, that's interesting. And I've certainly learned this from Charlie, but that intronic DNA that in theory was junk DNA is encoding all kinds of interesting things like circular RNAs and mirrors and God knows what else.
Well, in the cancer space, they also just pile up mutations because some of them are very tolerant to being mutations. And some of these tumors, lung cancer, skin cancer, hundreds of thousands of mutations. This is a huge opportunity to go looking for them in the blood because you don't have to get every mutation perfect. You just have to find enough of them that you can say, yes, this blood sample is from a cancer patient or someone to become a cancer patient or not.
So that leads to my question, which is obviously highly appropriate in the circumstances. Okay, so now you've explained it to us like we were peers. Now explain us this, your findings to us like we're high school students, because that may finally bring me up to So I'm sitting in a high school class and you come in as a, you know, bring your dad to work day talk. And how do you explain this to me so I'm interested and understand what you do?
Yeah, the most important part is we're all made of cells. That's really the fundamental starting point. And any one of those cells at any time has the potential to go off the rails, have its biology act in a strange way and become cancer. So we want to know what cell that is, and we want to know when that derailment of cells are going to happen. And it's inevitable. Sometime at some point in your body, a cell will stop being a normal cell. So we want to use this blood test to check when those cells crack open and shed their DNA into your blood. We want to be able to find and time when that happened.
And it's interesting, like even in people that don't have disease, you were showing that we're all shedding DNA into our blood. Like there's some background level of DNA there all the time. And in different diseases, there may be different patterns, and cancer is just one collection of diseases.
My colleague Dan Lando just gave a great talk in Toronto. He's from New York. He came visit us in Toronto, gave a fascinating example of, he was looking at esophagus of old, middle-aged, and young. And he had this beautiful slide of just mutations in a piece of tissue. And you could see just by eye in the young person, there are a few mutations, hardly any there. In the senior citizen, just packed, little tiny clones that have kind of grown out locally. So we're all full of these mutations. He just looked at esophagus, but the idea was this affects all of our tissue. We're always accumulating mutations at all time. Most of the time they don't do anything, but in our cancer field, we want to know the ones that are on the path of leading to cancer.
Sounds like getting older is bad for your health.
That's what I'm told, and I'm finding that out day by day.
Yes.
So every professional has a bump in the road story of various descriptions. What's yours?
Yeah, I think my bumps in the road are small and recurrent. I think coming to grips with sort of the realities of not every science project is a winner. And I think going down sometimes a rabbit hole or sometimes for multiple years pursuing an idea, and just sometimes it just doesn't work out. Sometimes the hypothesis is just wrong or just the data just doesn't support it. And I think really coming to grips with that science is not this straight shot. It's this crooked road. Even once you start your own lab, not every pillar, not every specific aim is going to be a winner.
So with funding being kind of complex and hard to get hold of because money's never kind of flowing freely, do you find that that kind of not every idea works is kind of hampered by the funding kind of ecosystem? Or do you think you have enough flexibility to go down dead ends in your research?
Yeah, I don't feel penalized for asking a question that didn't necessarily pan out. And I say it's a dead end, but that's actually not true. We always learn something, even from the projects that don't lead to some big flashy publication. So I think having some of that sort of undesignated funding is extremely important in science, just so scientists can pivot or take an idea or take a finding that wasn't what they expected and then start to chase it down. And maybe a good example is I actually had done no cell-free DNA in any of my training until I started my lab at Princess Margaret. And it was really that buddy grant. They had an internal funding system. They wanted an MD and a PhD to team up. So I got a message from Suzanne Trudell, hematologist at Princess Margaret, who wanted to do bone marrow aspirates all the time. And no patient's going to sign up for multiple bone marrow aspirates. And that's where this idea of what if we could do this in blood? What if we could take all that thinking from tissue genomics and apply it to this totally new disease area kind of came from?
Small.
In the question period this morning, we were discussing a negative trial where people in the UK were trying to use a blood test for genetic signatures to predict cancer, and it came up negative. And I don't know if you, because I think that test is still available. Can you just tell us about that?
Yeah, I followed this work extremely closely, extremely ambitious. They were definitely swinging for a home run. So I think on its face, in terms of a primary endpoint, it may have been negative. But I think that's actually a great example. I can guarantee the company sponsoring that study learned an enormous amount about deployment at scale, some of the molecular features intrinsic to their test. But it does also highlight the importance of asking perhaps more narrow questions before you go extremely broad. And that's what we've tried to do in the CHARM Consortium. In that case you cite, they were going after the entire national NHS, entire health system in the UK. Our focus in CHARM is much more narrow in that we're focused on people with extremely high genetic risk, sometimes 100% risk of cancer in their lifetime. And I think that's really across all of cancer, actually. It's the hereditary cancer that have really led to some of these very large impact across all of cancer types by answering a very narrow question first and then broadening it out rather than trying to jump maybe a little more quickly.
And these cancer syndromes, for again, for people listening, are things like GI tumors with so-called Lynch syndrome, L-Y-N-C-H, and then there's other cancer syndromes that you're interested in studying.
Yeah, and the story I'm going to talk about this afternoon is about how the CHARM Consortium started with a focus on Li-Fraumeni syndrome, carrier of a mutation in P53. This is a guardian of the genome. Every single cell in these individuals' bodies have that first hit. And they only have one guardian left. We have two genes. They're born with one missing or mutated. So they have an entire surveillance system around them to search every single year for developing cancer. And it's a real opportunity for something that's highly accessible, like a blood test, to be used more routinely as part of that surveillance.
Interesting. Well, so I guess the next question then is, let's look to the future. So 10 years from now, when you come back to Queen's and give a lecture on the status of blood testing for DNA mutations and cancer prediction, what do you think the practice will be 10 years from now, if you were to guess?
Yeah, I think it's extremely effective, accessible type of test. So where I would like to see it is really at those three time points I talked about this morning. I think using cell-free DNA in that predisposition setting, currently we're focused on hereditary cancer. There's a big opportunity to expand some of those analyses out to the general population, maybe not for surveillance, but I think for risk prediction. There's a debate in my field around polygenic risk scores, taking multiple variants across the genome to predict your risk for all manner of disease. This area is an area of hot research. It's all in your DNA that's in your cell-free DNA. So I could see a very comprehensive first-line whole genome test. I could see a second test if that first test finds cancer that might go deeper to say what type of cancer it is, what treatments do you have. Ideally, this would be informed by data sharing around the world. And I speak specifically of the rare tumors. This is really the hardest nut to crack are these tumors we don't know much about. And in pediatric cancer, we encounter this all the time. The power of putting all that data from the rare tumors together so they're not so rare globally. So when you do get this type of blood test, you can comment not just on breast, lung, colon, but also some of the rare tumors, ovarian, sarcomas, some of the blood cancers.
So from a health economics perspective, do you, I don't know if you're looking into or kind of trying to understand that, but presumably these tests would lower the cost because you're going to be getting to cancers and diagnosing them sooner. Thus, you're going to be treating less and people are going to get back out healthier the other side a little bit more. Are you tracking how this might impact healthcare?
Yeah. So one of the other actors within the CHARM Consortium is Yvonne Bombard. She's an expert in health technology assessment, and this type of work is the sort of thing her lab would work on. It's extremely challenging in the genomics field because the cost, at least of the machine, of the sequencing rather, is just constantly getting cheaper and cheaper. The bigger challenge is what does that health system integration really have to look like? And I think that's really the area to get our heads around, especially the data systems needed to support frequent testing and some of the integration with the imaging or other data that we talked about previously. So it's definitely something that we've built into CHARM. Patients are interviewed, patients and providers are interviewed before they enter into the study, during the study, and that moment right after they get a positive result. And like, how have their attitudes changed? What are they thinking about how the results are being returned? Just so if this type of research is successful, we have some of that in the moment implementation and economic data sort of at the ready.
I'm thinking, I know we've tortured you enough here with all these questions, but this is a fascinating area of research. But I'm thinking of like some young woman that has a BRCA mutation and is at risk of breast cancer. So you might envision testing to show whether your genetic risk is associated with the development of a cancer. You might then have your mastectomy and chemotherapy or whatever and be followed to see if it's coming back with another blood test. Is that sort of the model that you're thinking will happen?
I think for the hereditary cancer carriers, that's a very good model. And some of them are really life-changing medical decisions. Do you have a hysterectomy to reduce your risk of cancer? Or you have your ovaries removed? When do you do that? Can you wait till you're through your childbearing years? Are you a carrier of a variant, but you still could be lower risk than other people who are not. So I think having access to a test that you could use more frequently and can more accurately pinpoint risk can help sort of plan out some of those, the timing of those medical interventions.
Okay, well, as Dr. Archer just said, we've subjected you some pretty tough questioning, but I'm afraid the worst is yet to come. So we've prepared some fairly specific questions that are really going to challenge you.
High level.
And we hope you're going to do well. What's your favorite meal and can you cook it yourself?
My favorite meal? Well, my wife's going to kill me for this one. There's a meatball, a molasses meatball and broccoli dish that my mom always made for my birthday when I was in Vancouver. So whenever we travel back, I always ask them to make this. It must be hideously unhealthy with molasses, ketchup, and the meatballs are really
excellent.
It's
very rich in iron, I should imagine.
So, with the broccoli there too.
Yeah, exactly.
So yeah, I do like this dish. I don't make it myself. My wife won't make it either. It was a phenomenal cook. But yeah, I do like this meal. And maybe it's the forbidden fruit angle that really makes it so sweet.
Probably was the whole birthday angle. So along similar lines, what type of music do you like and can you play music yourself?
I was a trombonist in high school. So I could play. I wouldn't say I couldn't describe myself as a trombonist now. We had a phenomenal music teacher at Point Grey Secondary. And he ran multiple jazz bands and a symphonic band. And especially the jazz bands really instilled a love of like Count Basie era, Duke Ellington era jazz. So this is the kind of music I'll often listen to. I don't play it, but I have a lot of familiarity with those songs. We used to play it in high school jazz band. So that has really stuck with me like over the decades.
Interesting.
What's the strangest job you've ever done?
The strangest job, it was probably the in-home computer repair because we were called all over the city. Like we had large corporate base, but one of our strongest customers was A&W. And some of them would have a computer in the back room, but some of them were quite small. You can shoehorn these restaurants all over the place.
Yeah, they're franchised.
And they had one that was like right next to the fryer, and that computer constantly needed work. The CD-ROM drive, we had CD-ROMs at the time, would sort of glide out and glide back in. So
bearings were well-graced.
They kept us well-fed, so that also instilled in me a warm spot for A&W, going back and fixing this poor computer. It was just.
We're gonna have to talk about your diet between molasses meatballs and A&W. So, if you could travel in time, would you travel forward or backwards?
Oh, I would absolutely travel forward. Now is the best time to be alive, and next week is going to be better. So, I don't know how far forward I would travel, but especially in my field, I always want to know, like, where is this invention going to go? Where's the field going to go? I'm more of a futurist.
You're not worried that you go to the future and it's ruled by damn dirty apes?
It could be, but that's a great movie. I don't know.
There's an optimist here. I like that. I can
something
that.
To, be, to be found. Yeah.
Okay, so lastly, and this is probably the most important question that you'll get asked this year. If you were a cartoon character, which one would you be and why?
I think it's Professor Farnsworth from Futurama.
Okay.
For people who watch Futurama, he's an extraordinarily old, super creative, ultra positive scientist. He runs a space delivery company and he really cares about his team. He's got like a whole squad of oddballs who all, he's a professor, he has a graduate student involved. Always has an invention or a crazy idea to bail the gang out of trouble. His catchphrase, good news, everyone, really resonates. Even when there's terrible news, it's always good news.
We're going to have to work on that mantra. you sound optimal for an academic. Dr. Pugh, on behalf of Dr. Archer and myself, I'd like to thank you for taking your time out of your busy schedule to talk to our audience today about your research and about your future plans. And to our listeners, I'd like to thank you for taking time to get to know Dr. Pugh with us and hope that you enjoyed the show too. If you did enjoy this episode and would like to know more about research at Queen's University or indeed share this podcast, you can search for Time to Talk Science and Medicine wherever you normally look for podcasts. Trevor, thank you.
Thank you.